Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Shailen Romney Garrett. She is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam, on the book Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. A little bit about Shailen. She is a social entrepreneur. Her degree is in government from Harvard. She spent time in the Peace Corps and is a founding contributor to David Brooks' Aspen Institute initiative, WEAVE, the Social Fabric Project. Her writing has appeared in Time, the New York Times, as well as other publications, and you can read more about her efforts on her blog, Project Reconnect. Besides the book we're talking about today, Shailen contributed to American Grace, How Religion Divides and Unites Us, which won Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson Award for Best Political Science Book of 2010 and 11. So we welcome once again to Common Threads, Shailen Romney Garrett. Hello, Shailen.
Hi there. Nice to be with you again.
Yes. Let's back up just a little bit in case somebody is joining us this week that didn't join us last week. So your book, Upswing, discusses the very challenging times that America was going through 100, 120 years ago, and how so much of what they were going through back then mirrors many of the situations we find ourselves in today. And you claim that there was an upswing, hence the title of the book, gave us about 70 years of relatively prosperous times. And then around the mid-60s, there started a decline, and we find ourselves where we are today. But the book does offer optimism that we can work out of that to find our former glory of the earlier part of the 20th century. Is that a fair estimation of things?
Yeah, I mean, I think the upswing was not so much about moving toward prosperity, but it was about moving toward a greater and greater sense of we. A greater and greater sense that we want to share the economic pie. So,
I meant prosperity in a more holistic term. Honestly, I did.
Right.
It wasn't just how much money's
love
in
that,
your pocket.
I love that, actually. Yep.
Yeah. Okay.
I love that.
But go ahead.
So that prosperity manifested as economic equality. It manifested as growing political comedy. Political comedy is not a term you hear often, but it's the opposite of political polarization. It's the ability of politicians to cooperate in the public square, to work together. That was increasing over that 70-year period, as was our sense of togetherness. People were forming families earlier and more often. They were joining. They were participating in communities. They were bowling together over the course of that period. We also saw a growing cultural sense that we're all in this together, that society's not a competition, that it's a cooperative effort. So all of those things were moving sort of in a positive direction over that 70-year period. And then remarkably, all those different trends turned in the opposite direction in roughly the mid-1960s, landing us back today in a very eye moment, just as we had been back in the last Gilded Age.
You know, when you mentioned the 1960s, and certainly the 60s were quite turbulent in many ways, but when you talk about the me and we consciousness, when you bring in the youth movement, the hippies and the yippies, didn't they attempt to turn the tide? They were certainly thinking in many ways about more we things. You had the back to the earth movement, the communalism movement. Now, admittedly, the youth culture in the 1960s had a lot of dysfunction in it. A lot of it was drug infused. There was a lack of responsibility toward families and all of that. But what did your research indicate about that particular movement?
Well, what's so interesting about the 60s is that exactly what you say is true. Like, it had both things in it, right? Like, it had these very communitarian movements that then, but also these other elements that seemed very, you know, anti-communitarian. And I think what you're actually seeing there is that the 60s was a pivot. We entered the 60s with a very we energy. The communes, the folk music, you know, the Joan Baezes, the let's all get together and solve all of these problems and let's finally get over our racial divisions. And that was the energy that had built off of that long, slow ascent toward a greater and greater sense of we. That was a huge part of what the 60s were about. But then that energy actually sort of backflipped and went in another direction, right? So famously, we document in the book many ways in which, from a cultural perspective, you can sort of see this pivot play out quite starkly in the 1960s. So, for example, you had Bob Dylan, you know, being this very folksy communitarian singer that then at the Newport Folk Festival gets on stage and starts doing this electric guitar routine, and everybody's like, what? They sort of boo him off the stage. And this, he was this, that was a very emblematic moment of him shifting in a much more sort of individualistic direction, right? Away from the folk music and into sort of a more exploratory, individualistic mode. You see it in the Beatles, right? It went from All You Need Is Love and Let's All Get Together to the later work of the Beatles, which one of the last songs that they recorded together ever was called I, Me, Mine. All I look around and all I see is I, Me, Mine. Those are the lyrics, right? And so that you can see the way that we started the 60s one way and we ended the 60s another way. And that's what's so fascinating about this is that's not just something that was clear in the culture. When you look at hard measures, and we're talking about scores of data sets that we look at in this book, you see that pivot away from economic equality, away from political cooperation, away from joinerism and communitarianism, and away from a cultural focus on the fact that we're all in this together. It all happened in roughly the same moment. It's really a breathtaking phenomenon.
Last week, we began part of this conversation of spirituality. And I wanted to continue on that because that's kind of sort of the theme of our show here. So last week you mentioned that the social gospel was a very prominent contributor to this understanding of a more we culture, that it actually inspired the thought leaders and the politicians and I'm assuming business leaders to go in a particular direction. How did the religious thinkers of the 60s and 70s pull us back, if in fact they did? Was there a movement that was sort of a backlash to that social gospel?
Yeah, I mean, I think an interesting foil to the social gospel movement is the prosperity gospel movement, right? Which is that the idea that, you know, God rewards the righteous with material prosperity. And so I should be righteous because it's good for me, you know, which is a very different mindset to the idea that, you know, the social gospelers put forward, which is that Christianity is a really a blueprint for an egalitarian society, and creating a society is about what we can do for each other, what we owe to each other. That's a very different way of thinking just about Christianity, for example, right? And that so that prosperity gospel has gained steam over the course of the last several decades, you know, kind of reaching a peak, so to speak, in what we see with mega churches and you know, churches that are very consumer-oriented, right? The making a church experience meet the needs of the individual. So I did a lot of ethnographic research at different religious congregations for my work on the American Grace book, which was also co-authored with Robert Putnam. And my job was to really get a feel for what religion looks like in various different context in America. And so I spent time at some of these mega churches, and it was amazing to me how they were very open about the fact that they were creating a consumer-driven church. They were about meeting the needs of the individual Christian consumer, right? By having coffee shops on the church grounds. And, you know, and so that's just a very different way of thinking about even Christianity. Now, Christianity is, of course, just one religion, but it's an example of that shift that can manifest even in our theology, right? The same religion, but the emphasis that we put can be very I or very we. Depends.
One of the things that I see, an argument that I've seen over the last couple of decades, is a real theological one that has inserted itself into politics. And here's how it goes. Liberals tend to say, liberal Christians who are in politics will say, Jesus commanded us to feed the poor, to take care of the sick, etc., etc. And we want to do that through political means. The conservative says, no, get your hands off of my money. I want my money not to go to the federal government so that it can create more social programs. I want it to go to my church so that it, along with other churches, can be the ones to fix the fabric of American society. Is that something that you've explored?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's, what the first thing I think of here is that is Jonathan Haidt's work, right, on the sort of the moral psychology behind different political positions. It's not that some people, you know, the people on the right are more moral or less moral or than the people on the left. It's that there are different moral emphases on either side, right? So people on the left tend to be emphasizing the morality of sort of taking care of the vulnerable. People on the right tend to be emphasizing the morality of loyalty to authority or, you know, other things like that. And so that's one thing that comes to mind, is that we have seen a bit of a sorting around different ways of thinking about how our public square should manifest our morality. But I do think that what you're bringing up is slightly different than that, which is a question of centralization versus decentralization, right? And interestingly, it's a question of whether the federal government should be enacting our shared morality or whether we should be enacting that more on a grassroots scale. So I want to just go back to some of the lessons of the upswing and some of the lessons of the last progressive era, right? When we tend to think of the progressive era, we tend to think of big federal programs taking care of consumers, taking care of child laborers, you know. But I want to emphasize that stuff came quite late, actually, in the process. Earlier, that stuff grew out of the work that was being done at the level of the tenement, at the level of the neighborhood, at the level of the church, right? There was a real flowering of citizen innovation at the local level that really drove this upswing. And it was political entrepreneurs who came along somewhat late in the process to sort of build federal programming around those and make those innovations that were working at the state or the municipal level accessible to all Americans. And so interestingly, the progressive era itself had both of these components, right? It had a strong grassroots taking care of our own and experimenting with solutions as citizens that then bubbled up into federal programs. So today, I do think it's a bit of a mistake to look at the federal level first and say, you know, the way that we're going to solve poverty is to legislate our way into equality. Because what that does is it skips the harder work of doing things at the local level, which I think actually forces us to engage with one another as citizens, to see how the other half lives, to ourselves be part of the solution rather than just looking to the government. That's certainly how the upswing happened last time. And I'm not addressing specifically your question of how that maps on to sort of theology and religion, but I do think it's a lesson from the upswing about where we should put our efforts first if we want another upswing to be long lasting, we can't just legislate our way into a we mindset.
No, that makes perfect sense. And I think that it does answer the question fairly well. If you're just joining us, you're listening to WGVU's Common Threads. I'm Fred Stella. With me today is Shailen Romney Garrett. She is the co-author, along with Robert Putnam, of the book Upswing, How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. When you say that the social Darwinism that you talked about last week, that has also made a reappearance today. Is that something that people use as an operating thought force, that society should be made up of survivors as opposed to everyone?
Well, I don't think that people use that language today, but I do think that the sentiment is definitely there. So when you look, for example, at Silicon Valley, I mean, where does a lot of the culture making around our economics come from today? It comes from Silicon Valley. And when you dig into what are the sort of animating ideas behind a lot of these tech moguls that have come to really shape our society, who was their touchstone? It was Ayn Rand, you know? And so that phenomenon is very real, that there is a very sort of I, me, mine. It's actually best for society for all of us to pursue our own interests and not worry about others. That drove a lot of what Silicon Valley has become today. And a lot of what's driving our broader thinking culturally is Silicon Valley, because who do we look to as the sort of cultural icons of what success is? We look to, you know, those individuals who have employed that mindset to get to where they are. They don't necessarily wear that on their sleeve, I don't think, but is it a certainly, you know, big underlying cultural phenomenon? It is. Looks different today than it did in the social Darwinism, but I think that the features of it are there. And also, I think, you know, when I listened to the last couple of speeches that Trump gave as he was leaving office, he said in no uncertain terms, he said, you know, this is a movement about your government serving you. The government serves the citizens. And that's what this is about. This is about you getting what's yours and the government being the instrument of you getting that, you know, versus the classic John F. Kennedy, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So we've definitely had a rhetorical shift in terms of putting number one. That's what we do today.
Alex de Tocqueville is someone who comes up an awful lot when we talk about the earlier times in our country and how Europe then viewed us through his lens. And he said that we, meaning Americans, pursue self-interest rightly understood. So talking about this, we're number one, or looking out for number one, that is certainly self-interest. But what is self-interest rightly understood?
Yeah, thank you for bringing this up, because I think sometimes people often mistake the argument that we're making in the upswing to be, you know, we should go all in on communitarianism. Like, what we need is to just get back to that, like, hyper-communitarianism. Well, no, I mean, the solution to hyper-individualism is not hyper-communitarianism. What's amazing about America is that it's always had a balance between individualism and communitarianism. That's actually what Alexis de Tocqueville spotted when he came here in the 1830s. A lot of people don't realize this, because Alexis de Tocqueville is sort of considered like the patron saint of communitarianism. But he actually coined the term individualism. And so he was able to see these two components of American society, that we were people fiercely committed to liberty and to individual self-determination, but that we understood that our interests could only really be served from a long-term perspective when we worked together. And so what self-interest rightly understood is Tocqueville's way of trying to describe this fairly unique balance that he saw in America between in people who really wanted their liberty and their freedom, their self-determination, but who recognized that the only way that they were going to get what they wanted and needed, security, prosperity, these public goods, was to work together. And they did that through vast association building. And so America has always been about that balance. What we saw in the last Gilded Age and what we see today is that we've gotten way out of balance. We've put the emphasis way too far on I. We need to get us back to a bit of more balanced situation. And the last thing that I'll say is, you know, one thing that might have driven the downturn, the flip that happened in the 1960s from we back to I, is really that we went too far in the direction of we. A lot of the pushback in the 50s, culturally speaking, was about conformity, that people just felt that the we was too constrictive, it was too prescriptive. And so they were pushing back against that. And that may have been a healthy pushback. I think that just 70 years later, we've seen that we've taken it way too far.
You know, that's something I've never thought of. But now that it's in my head, here's what I'm cogitating on. This understanding of conformity, and you are absolutely correct, the 50s, the Mad Men era, was definitely a time of conformity. And it was opposed, it was mocked by people on the left, who are often considered communitarians. But what was one of the slogans of the 60s counterculture? Do your own thing. Mm-hmm. So things kind of get convoluted. You can't use right and left, progressive, conservative. You can't just separate the camps that easily when it comes to looking at this big picture.
Not at all. I mean, it is very much not the case that either the right or the left was pushing the I agenda. Both were pushing it, but with different language. So on the left, you had the do your own thing, don't tread on me, sort of the I manifested as a desire to be sort of culturally self-determined. And on the right, it manifested as a don't tread on me in economics. I reserve my right to be economically self-determined. It was the same I ethos. It was just being talked about and manifested in these different ways on both sides of the political spectrum. But it was there, primarily it manifested across the spectrum as what has been called rights talk. What happened was a broad move away from talking about responsibilities and shared responsibilities and toward talking about rights. Society was not about our responsibilities to each other. It was about the rights that I can be given and that can be guaranteed to me by that society. That's the broad movement across the spectrum that we saw in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was just manifesting differently on either side of the spectrum.
And, of course, we still see that today to some extent. The first thing that comes to mind is the gun rights movement, people mm-hmm. talking about their Second Amendment rights, but often with little sense of responsibility. I don't mean to mm-hmm. point those people out solely, but that's just kind of what popped into my head. Shaylin, we have just a few minutes left, and I so appreciate the insight that you've given us into the book Upswing, but I want to take these last couple of moments to ask you about something that has nothing to do with the book, but I was reading about you online, and I did not mention this in your short bio that I read, because your bio would take up half a program, trust me. Tell us about your work in Jordan and the Middle East in general.
Interestingly, my husband and I were both on an academic track, ready to join, you know, to do PhDs and sort of pursue that as a career. But there's always been in us this sense of wanting to serve and not being sure that academia was going to provide us with enough of that experience. And so we decided to put those applications on hold and instead join the Peace Corps. And we made a very deliberate decision to participate in a program that was being run by our government. We were very disillusioned after the Bush years, and we're not quite sure how we felt about America. And so in order to explore that, we actually decided to serve our country through the Peace Corps. And the Peace Corps placed us in Jordan. So we were there as teachers and volunteers for a couple of years. And that morphed into us founding a nonprofit, partnering with the Queen of Jordan to get some of our education initiatives into the public schools there, and turned into a six-year journey of living in the Middle East and starting our family in the Middle East and all of that. But interestingly, you know, I think what sparked it was a desire to reevaluate what America was to me, what I thought America was about, what America could be in the world. And that was an important formative experience for me, because living abroad changed my view of this country. It helped me to reconnect myself with what is unique and special about America, not letting go of the critiques that I was identifying, a lot of which had to do with this I focus that America has gotten into, but really recommitting myself to helping America rediscover its soul, helping America, to use familiar language from Biden, you know, to help America rethink getting back into balance between the I and the we, and thereby sort of rediscovering our promise. And that's the work I've been engaged in since I came home from Jordan.
That's wonderful. I so appreciate that and admire it. Shailen, we are done for this particular episode. Again, thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck on your upcoming ventures.
Thank you, Fred. It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Common Threads on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Shailen Romney Garrett has been my guest today. She, along with her co-author Robert Putnam, wrote the book Upswing: How America Came Together a Century Ago and How We Can Do It Again. Please join us next week here on Common Threads.